call our next case, which is 99-3193, Jamie Vandenberg versus Continental Insurance Company. And I'll read the lineup so we all are working off the same page. Mr. Evenson, 15 minutes, representing Jamie Vandenberg. Mr. Olson, 10 minutes, representing Dumpke Insurance Financial Services. 30 minutes, Gene Unger, representing the count, that's 30 minutes aside for a total of one. Don't have to use all your time if you don't want to. It's just you don't have time over that generally. Okay. Start with Mr. Evenson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Evenson. I'm an attorney with Sigmund Jansen Stack, Winning Seawall and Pitts in Appleton, Wisconsin. Our office represents the plaintiff and co-appellant in this action, Jamie Vandenberg. We are asking this court's assistance give us an interpretation of two common provisions in a homeowner's or renter's insurance policy. We have elected to divide our time, as indicated by the Chief Justice, to address both of the issues. I will be addressing the issue certified to this court by the Court of Appeals. Mr. Olson will be addressing the reformation issue, which is also before the court on appeal. I would welcome questions from the court at any time, especially given my abbreviated time here. All of the parties agree that this is a tragic case. It involves the death of my client's 8-month-old child, and from the REAL's perspective, it's certainly a tragic and haunting memory having an infant die in their home. I'm not going to go through a recitation of the facts as the gallery's been informed of the facts, and certainly the court is aware of them from the brief, but I would stress one fact to the court at the outset.
Counsel, would you make sure to speak up, please?
I'm sorry. I would stress one fact to the court at the outset, and that is that Justin Vandenberg died as a result of Jason Reel's action in placing four pillows on top of him. I think that's a critical fact for the court to keep in mind, and I believe it's also important to keep in mind that he was not engaged in any type of business pursuit as a 5-year-old child. In analyzing this policy, the initial grant of liability coverage in a homeowner's or renter's insurance policy is a broad grant of liability coverage. And then from this are carved out exclusions dealing with automobile insurance, exclusions for intentional injury, and the exclusion that we deal with here today is for business pursuits. And then after carving out that exclusion, the policy itself restores coverage under the exception to the exclusion for those activities which are usual to non-business pursuits. Unfortunately, the policy doesn't provide us with examples or any other language which would clarify the application and the interplay between the exclusion and the exception to the exclusion. The rationale behind these two provisions is important to a baseline understanding. From the insurer's perspective, they put in the exclusion because a business involves different underwriting criteria. It involves different risks. And they do not want to be providing coverage under a homeowner's policy beyond that which they have agreed to provide. From the insured's perspective, the exception restores coverage, as the Court of Appeals has put it, within the personal sphere of their life. And that's the coverage that the reasonable insured purchasing this type of policy expects. Important to keep in mind that the exception is within and modifies the business pursuit exclusion. So it's a recognition that there are going to be claims which arise in the business context, but which involve activities which are usable to non-business pursuits.
Give us some examples then under your view. In other words, it's clear there was a business exclusion. This is a homeowner, and then they had a business, and it was daycare, taking care of other children.
Correct.
So what would be excluded from coverage in this situation then? In other words, you're saying, well, because the child of the person providing the in-home care then that would be something that would happen usually. Are there other exclusions, or is that the only one? What if there was a, what if there was a visitor to the child, not under the daycare, but would that person also be excluded? Would there be coverage if it was a visitor?
I certainly believe that that is a good illustration of where the exception comes into play. You're illustrating the personal sphere of that life, and that's the coverage that's intended to be provided both as a general grant and then restored by this exception. That's the key distinction that we have here is, of course, that we have two actors. We have Mrs. Real and we have Jason Real. And it's our argument to this court that it is possible to have Mrs. Real operating in a dual capacity. On the one hand, certainly she's operating the daycare business, providing compensated care to three children. On the other hand, she's a stay-at-home mother to her three children and cares for them as a parent cares for a child.
Yeah, but you could have, I'm just thinking if you, I had a home and I had home insurance and I have a garage that's right attached to the house, and I'm doing a business, I'm repairing your muffler. And would that be the same situation, or the you're in the muffler repair business, it's in the home, and the child comes out and, I don't know, you can make it up, knocks the jack handle down and it crushes somebody. Wouldn't that be also under the same exception that you're advocating?
Your Honor,
in other words, it's an in-home, it's a business, there is the same exclusion the insurance company has. You know, this doesn't cover businesses, and a member of the household, that household causes the injury. Just a different business.
Yes, I believe that in that situation, if you're talking about a child causing an injury, and that child is a household member, they're not engaged in the business pursuit. They're being a normal child.
Counsel, are you finished? One of the things that makes this case difficult for me is the various focuses suggested by the parties as to what we focus in order to apply the exception to the exclusion. Now, I need help on this. There are two causes of action. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your
And
Honor.
One is based on vicarious liability and the other is based on negligent supervision. Is that correct or not correct?
That's incorrect, Your Honor.
Okay.
Our initial claim was against Mrs. Real for her negligence in failing to care for the child who died, a direct claim that she was negligent in providing that care. That we have conceded based upon the existing policy language and the holding of the Court of Appeals in the Ruff decision is barred. The second claim that we have brought, and it's not correctly stated as vicarious liability, it would be more correctly stated as parental negligence or parental failure to supervise and control.
I'm looking at the blue brief.
Yes.
The claim against Mrs. Real, on page 5, the claim against Mrs. Real that she failed to supervise and control her parent is based on her vicarious liability as a parent.
And Your Honor, the vicarious liability reference there, and counsel for respondent pointed that out, and I apologized for it in the reply brief, was an imprecise use of the phrase vicarious liability. My reference was to a parent's actual joint tortfeasorship with the child when the child commits the act that actually causes the harm. And my apologies to the court and to counsel for any confusion.
Because the child can't be liable here.
Correct. The child is afforded statutory protection in that a child under 7 cannot be found negligent.
So you can't, if it's vicarious liability, zero for the child, so it has to be zero for the parent. If it's vicarious liability.
Correct.
So you're going in under the claim of negligently failing to control
supervise.
Correct. The child, which is generally recognized in Wisconsin.
Yes,
as
Your
a tort
Honor.
Claim.
And your focus then is not, though, on the mother, but your focus is on the acts of the son.
We would certainly argue to the court that you have to look at those as distinct things, distinct facts in this case. And as I've indicated, it's the separateness of the actors, the separateness of the actions, the business pursuit on the part of Mrs. Real, or the dual pursuit, business pursuit and parenting, and the pursuit of Jason Real, a normal 5-year-old child, that distinguishes this case from Ruff and frankly fits it within the analysis offered by the Court of Appeals in Rufner as far as the separateness that must exist between the business pursuit context and the activity which gives rise to the injury.
Could I ask you a hypothetical?
Sure.
We have a rented property here.
Yes.
There is a man and wife and 3 children living in that property?
Correct.
And then they open a daycare?
Correct.
Before they open the daycare, do you think the toilet ever stopped up?
Could very well have.
Could they have had under a cupboard somewhere liquid plumber, whatever it is, all these things?
Poison.
My point is, suppose they opened the daycare and one of the children got into those terrible chemicals. Is keeping those chemicals on the property activities which are usual to non-business pursuits?
I think you present a much closer question, and the case law from the other jurisdictions which has been presented and which is referenced in the Court of Appeals certification would tell you that it depends upon whether you're construing the exception narrowly, as some courts have done, or broadly, as some courts have done, or whether the exception is found to be ambiguous, which is what other jurisdictions have done. You don't have the separate actor there. It's a closer issue.
Now, is this a standard clause in rental policies, homeowners policies, business policies, this exception?
I believe it to be so, Your Honor, in that there are annotations which speak about the cases which have been generated. Certainly a great deal of litigation has been engendered by this language, especially in the home daycare context where it becomes most difficult to apply.
As a matter of fact, we have a case pending, this one, that is a home daycare, and the home dog bites a child.
From our same circuit, the Outagamie County Court, and a different justice, in that case, at the same level, the court found that there was coverage.
Mm-hmm. Just looking at insurance general, it's a matter of cost also. In other words, if you were going to have a business in your home or a daycare in your home, and you told the insurance company, I'm going to have a daycare, I'm sure that the policy would be more expensive than one that wouldn't. So you have commercial daycare, people are in business, and you have coverage, obviously, when you're doing it in a commercial, but I'm just trying to figure out how this exception to the exclusion, excluding businesses, but then accepting where you have this would actually, to the insurance company, at least they base all of this on cost. So you get what you pay for.
An excellent point. I guess what I would suggest to the court is that the premium paid by the Reals for their renter's insurance policy covers or is intended to cover actions by their 5-year-old child, and that they have been paid that premium to cover the household members when they unintentionally cause injury.
So if you don't have children, and I mean you have no children, and it's a husband and wife or one single, you can have a daycare operation, but if you have children, then this your exception would then kick in.
Correct.
What if the child who had committed the negligent act causing the death had been one of the other kids at the daycare, not the defendant's own child, but one of the other kids for whom she was receiving compensation to take care of? would there wouldn't be any coverage.
I don't think that there would be coverage. It illustrates, if I may, it illustrates the incredible fact, intense analysis that each of these cases goes through at the trial court level and at any point on appeal.
So while you've emphasized the distinction here as being one of the fact that there is a separate actor, that really only goes so far. What you're emphasizing is the relationship between the actor and the one who is covered, the mom, right? And the relationship is mother and child. She's got a common law duty to supervise that child separate and apart from the daycare operation.
Correct.
Mr. Evenson, why shouldn't we focus on the victim? The victim would not have been there but for the business. Why shouldn't that be the focus?
Your Honor, and my stoplight is, but if I may respond.
Answer that, please.
The issue is really addressed, I think, in the Rufiner case, where the Court of Appeals rejects the but-for analysis that is argued by Continental. If this court accepts the but-for analysis, that is, but for this daycare, my client's son would not have died.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
If this client accepts the but-for analysis that but for the operation of this daycare, my child would not have died, that's true. But that test was specifically rejected in Rufiner in favor of the more refined analysis of context and activity within the context, and then viewing how those two are separated. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Nelson?
May it please the court, my name is Bruce Olson. I'm an attorney with the Green Bay office of Davis and Kielthau, and I'm here to represent the co-appellants and third-party defendants, Dumke Insurance Agency, and its agent, Mr. Fritz. I think we all know that we're here primarily to address this issue of the exception to the exclusion, but there is another issue that is before the court in terms of the procedure where we are now, and that has to do with the issue of reformation. So I do want to spend some time addressing the issue of reformation and our contention that Judge Dyer was in error when he determined that the policy could not be reformed in this case. However, I'm also perfectly willing to take any questions you may have on the coverage issues too, just to share my observations in that regard.
But counsel, before you do that, you were also, I believe, retained in the case because of the question as to whether you should have given them the opportunity to buy another policy dealing with the home, with the business. Is that correct?
That's not exactly correct. I think the reason we were
close enough.
But we're the insurance agent. The reason we were brought in was the allegation that we should have advised Mr. Real somehow that he should have gone ahead and purchased a daycare insurance.
And that was not dismissed?
No. The judge found that there were some questions of fact. We petitioned, but the petition was not accepted by this court, and so that is not an issue technically before you.
Right. But I'm just trying to clarify that regardless of what happens in this case, it has to be remanded on that issue, and that's still alive.
I think that issue is alive, but I think it may be impacted on the decision that you make, and that gets into the question of reformation and why I'm raising that.
Okay.
But you're right that it would have to still go back and be addressed in that regard. In this case, we have Judge Dyer making a specific factual finding that Mr. Real did not ask for daycare coverage when he filled out the application with the agent, Mr. Fritz. And on that basis, the judge determined that one of the factual predicates for reformation was not met, and therefore he ruled as a matter of law the policy could not be reformed. At the same time, he made the finding that there was a question of fact as to the insurance agent recognizing no request for coverage had been made to him, yet because there had been some discussion in prior efforts to obtain previous coverage, that somehow the agent should have gone to its file, recognized that there was an issue, and affirmatively bring that forward to Mr. Real's attention. I think that the law is quite clear in Wisconsin that that type of duty does not exist for an insurance agent. But the problem that I see here relating to reformation in terms of the court making that finding and yet having a factual finding of the absence of a request is that to put a duty on an agent to infer what the insured may want and affirmatively bring it to his attention, in essence, creates a de facto request for coverage. That brings us then to the law of reformation as it applies to insurance agents rather than reformation generally. And as we all know, in those circumstances, we're not dealing with a traditional mutual mistake of fact. We're dealing with this unilateral mutual mistake of fact. And that is where I believe there is error in part of the, on the part of the trial court in terms of its analysis. And I also believe that is where there are questions of fact that remain, not only on that issue, but also specifically on the issue of whether or not the Continental policy would have been issued if this error had not been made. So if we assume arguendo that the agent should have done something to bring this to the attention but failed to procure the coverage, then the question is that a mistake? I would argue it is a mistake, and then the question becomes, would the carrier have issued coverage but for that mistake? And that then gets into the questions that were raised in terms of the depositions that were taken of the underwriting people at Continental and the questions raised in terms of the adequacy of the memo that was kept in the underwriting department that had not, never been disseminated to insurance agents, had not been followed in terms of any express activity on the part of the underwriter in underwriting these types of policies, and the stated position of the company that they were not out to eliminate having homeowners insurance apply if there were daycare situations. So I think in that context that we have a factual dispute that's there, an erroneous decision by Judge Dyer, and I think that this should be sent back to the trial court for further proceedings in that regard, keeping Continental in the case at least through the point of having a full development of those facts at trial.
Mr. Olson, it seems to me that there is a barrier to your case that's difficult for you to overcome, and I'd like to address it. Somewhere in this record, I read that, or in the briefs, that Continental Insurance Company presented undisputed evidence that they would not write a renter's policy if a daycare was being provided, the place of rental. Now, was that undisputed? And if it was undisputed, then why wasn't summary judgment correct? Because that seems to answer it. That seems to answer the question that reformation could not occur because the policy would never have been written.
That's the position of the carrier. But as I indicated, when we did discovery of the specific underwriters to see whether or not the carrier actually followed that particular practice, there were questions that were raised whether, in fact, the company did follow that procedure. So there were ambiguities in terms of what the procedure was. There was an absence of providing this type of information to the agents in terms of the agents being aware of what the underwriting criteria were on the part of the company. And we felt that to that extent, that at least raised issues that needed to be factually developed and assessed by a finder of fact, at least in an advisory verdict, as is typically the case with the insurance agent reformation cases, although obviously the judge makes the ultimate decision on reformation, typically the question of whether the company would have issued is one that is given to the jury in a fact-finding context.
Could I give you ask you a policy question?
Yes, sir.
Why shouldn't all daycares, commercial daycares, have insurance that's going to cover the accidents that are going to happen, whether they are whether they arise from activities that are which are usual to non-business pursuits or not? Why shouldn't every daycare have insurance that's going to cover not only these facts, but the hypothetical that Justice Sykes posed, the hypothetical that I posed?
I think in general there ought to be such a requirement. I think the distinguishing factor we have here is that there is no existing requirement that that be the case, and in the absence of any statutory obligation to do so, it's left in the hands of the day caregivers to choose if they want to purchase such insurance or not. Then you get into a situation in these unique situations with home daycare involved where you have your own child also under your care, and you end up in a situation as we have here where is your child causing ultimately the harm that is suffered, and the allegation then is that it is not your failure to supervise the child, your own child, within the context of daycare, but rather in fulfilling the greater duty of a parent. And that brings in the exception to the exclusion and why we believe it applies in this particular case. It may well be that this is one of the very few unique circumstances where it might apply, but because of the specific fact pattern we have here, I do believe that it does apply. I see I'm blocking my light, so
that's okay. Still have time.
All right. Any other questions on the insurance coverage issue that I can share with you?
Well, what's the purpose of this exception to the exclusion? You know, if you read it broadly, that exclusion is out. If you read it broadly, everything gets covered under the exception. If you read it narrowly, it can become meaningless. So what's the point of this? I mean, for example, many people have consulting arrangements where they use their part of their home. Then things are going to happen. Accidents are going to happen, or incidents are going to happen, I should say. So how do you have a rule that that is neutral and that can be applied across the board that makes sense out of this exception?
I don't know that one can do that, because the flip side of the hypothetical you just posed in terms of interpretation could also apply, and you could apply the exclusion across the board to always exclude activities, even those which would not be in the nature of relating to the business that's going on at the particular home or apartment. And so I think really we come down to a situation where we have to look at these on a case-by-case basis depending on the specific facts that we have. And it's unique in this case because of the fact that the child was acting as the child's, as a child, not as a member of the daycare unit.
How do we know the child wasn't a member of the daycare unit? Usually if there's a child in the home, it participates with other children if they're the age is right.
Well,
they'll
I think
go down and nap at the same time, maybe in the same room.
I think the focus has been on the conduct of the mother as it relates to her obligation to care for that child, and then it's the child's actions that pull us into the exception to the exclusion. I don't think that there's been a factual development here that addressed the issue specifically of how the young real child fit into that particular fact pattern, whether she lined everybody up in the high chairs and fed them all at once, and whether she put everybody down like nap time at kindergarten or what you would get with a traditional daycare.
So you think that has to be developed?
I think that has to be developed, and I think, again, you need to look at it in the totality of the specific facts here.
What does the court say is the standard for determining the exception? I mean, if it's going to be developed, we still have to have a rule of law.
I think that we do have a rule in terms of the methodology that the Rufner case puts forward. I think that it gives you good guidance and gives you an opportunity to look at various factors. It gives a combination of some subjectivity but also some very specific objective factors, and I think on that basis we do have a good rule of law. It just needs to be applied specifically to this case.
Thank you, counsel. This is a summary judgment case.
Right.
Thank you. Attorney Unger.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jean Unger, and I am the attorney representing the respondent, the Continental Insurance Company. Your Honors, the test articulated by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in Bartell that was further refined more recently in the Rufner case strikes the proper balance between the business pursuits exclusion and its exception, and it's a test that should be adopted by this court. The Rufner test strikes the proper balance because it permits the exclusion of claims that arise out of risks which are usually associated with the policyholder's business, yet it permits the grant of coverage for claims that arise out of risks that are not usually associated with the policyholder's business. It has the advantage, Your Honors, as opposed to a number of tests adopted around the country, that one can articulate it and one can apply it.
Counsel, apparently you're both arguing the same case and the same test.
Right.
Would you explain to me the differences in your approach for imploring that we apply the same case and the same test?
Sure, Your Honor. I think it's right. I think that we do both agree that Rufner sets the test in Wisconsin. We both agree that you have to look at the context, and we both then agree that there are objective facts to determine whether or not something is usual to the non-business pursuit. The difference, at least my understanding from reading the brief that was submitted to you but first submitted in the Court of Appeals, comes really from the Dumpke brief, where, and I go through it at length, probably at nauseam, I apologize, in my brief about they indicate that they believe that Rufner stands for the proposition that the activity giving rise to the injury, specifically the one that is at question about whether or not it's in the exception, whether or not there's a profit motive. And I just flat out say that that's a misreading of Rufner, that it says no such thing. Profit motive goes to whether or not you've got a business in the first instance. The second and probably more fundamental difference between the two of us is, what is the Rufner court saying about how you determine whether an activity is usual to non-business pursuits? Appellants would argue that you look to how often does the activity occur outside the business. And I maintain, and I am confident that Rufner says, that is not the perspective. The perspective is that you look to see how often the activity is engaged in during the business. And if it's engaged in frequently during the business, and if it's engaged in near the time of the profit motivated behavior, and if it's engaged in near or on your business premises, then it is something that is normally associated with the business, and it is intended to be excluded by the business pursuits exclusion. The purpose of the exception, in response to Justice Abramson's question, the purpose of the exception is that the carrier recognizes that there are times in a personal business that liability will result from an activity that isn't a risk that's normally associated with that business. And if it's a risk that's not normally associated with the business, then it should be covered. But if it's a risk that is normally associated with the business, then it's got to be excluded, because the whole point is to exclude risks that are associated with personal businesses.
Well, now, here, the activity of taking care of one's own child, at least for this mother, is engaged in frequently during the business, right?
Yes.
And it's near and on business premises,
yes.
Right? Therefore, you would say, I think, that it's normally associated with the business, therefore no coverage. Is that
right? That's
right. Okay. But the purpose of the exception is that the carrier recognizes that liability should be given for a risk that liability shouldn't be given for a risk normally associated with the business. Now,
Right.
Normally associated with the business at daycare is not the risk that your kid's going to hurt somebody. So I find that the two tests conflict in this case.
Your Honor, that's precisely what Riffner is trying to get at. How do you determine whether or not a risk is normally associated with business? So you have to examine it in the context of the business that is before you. So here we have to examine, did Stephanie Real, was the supervision of her child a risk that was normally associated with her daycare business? What I don't believe you can
What's
do
What's your answer to that?
Is absolutely it was. She watched him simultaneously with the daycare while she was providing daycare. She did it while she was doing the profit motive and on her premises.
Suppose a neighbor child wandered over.
Well, and that would get to, I believe, the question Justice Wilcox answered earlier. And again, it has to be case-specific. You have to look at the business that's before you. Does that kid come over every day at 1 o'clock when he gets up for a nap and his mom wants him to come over and basically kind of get taken care of? Because if he does, and he's a normal part of the routine of her daycare business, then it's a risk that's normally associated with it. If it's much more sporadic, much less frequent, then you are getting more towards, no, this is not a risk that is normally associated with her business. And that's the beauty of Riffner. Riffner is a test that can be articulated. It doesn't matter how many actors or how many tortfeasors there are or how many theories of liability there are. It teaches us how, in any given case, to figure out when is a pursuit usual to non-business.
Well, if that's the case, then how could you almost never have a summary judgment? Wouldn't this be a jury determination? Or a fact finder determination?
Well, it may be. It is certainly possible, Your Honor, that there could be some factual questions about whether or not the activity is usual or not usual to the business. And in maybe the child who comes over sporadically, it is. We do, though, have a number of Court of Appeals opinions coming out, and specifically Bartell and the Ruff case, where that was the issue before the court. Hooking up the trailer to the trailer hitch in Bartell, that was a question. They didn't remand it for a question of fact. They said, you know, it must have been the deposition testimony or something, basically establishes that, yeah, this is a normal part of this guy's business. In Ruff, it was, well, I was going to go to the beach anyway. She testified that she took daycare outings, you know, and so they said this is one of those outings. It falls in. They didn't remand it for a factual finding, and I don't think you have to in this one, Your Honor, because we know, I mean, it's uncontested that she supervises Jason and her other two children the entire time she's doing daycare unless Jason's out playing with friends. We know where it's done. We know how often it's done. We know, you know, all of the evidence we need to apply Riffner is on the record and it's uncontested. So at least this particular case is not one that needs to be determined by any additional factual finding.
Are you
I'm
done
sorry,
answering
Your Honor.
That, Ms. Ungers?
Pardon me?
Are you done answering the Chief?
I am.
Because I have a question.
Sure.
The normal rule, as you well know, of interpreting insurance contracts is that ambiguous language is interpreted against the insurer.
Yeah.
Why is this language not ambiguous? Particularly given the fact that courts around the country, certainly as wise as anybody else, have differed completely as to what this language means. And that, to me, is per se indicative that, hey, this language can be interpreted either way, and since it can be, we have to go with the plaintiff.
Well, Your Honor, there's a number of responses I'd like to make. First of all, in order for language to be considered ambiguous, it has to be subject to two differing reasonable interpretations. This argument's been made and rejected.
So the courts that have decided against you are unreasonable?
First of all, they haven't decided against me.
Right.
But
against your position.
I would advance that yes. Those courts that hold, and they are particularly the courts out of Virginia and Tennessee, those courts that say we only look to the activity, we don't consider them in context, we only look to the activity, and is caring for a child something people normally do outside of business? Of course. Is everything else that's done in daycare normally outside the course of normally pursuit that's usual to non-business? Yes, you know, caring for children, feeding children, you know, so that every claim that would arise out of daycare would fall within the exception, and I think that's unreasonable. It's apparent that the company was trying to exclude business pursuits that were associated with the risks, but grant a limited coverage if it happened to be related to the business but was a risk that was not usual to the business pursuit. So first, I don't believe that the test that's adopted that goes against us is reasonable. And the test that the appellants are advancing basically is that. They keep saying, you know, we have to look, you know, people supervise their children 24/7 and therefore it's something that's usual to non-business pursuits.
But counsel, I agree with you that your interpretation is a reasonable interpretation. But in order to go with you, I'm going to have to find that all these other courts are unreasonable in their interpretation. And at least so far, I look at this language and I say, boy, you know, it's almost a flip of the coin.
Justice Babich, I think I've demonstrated to you that if you were to apply that test in the daycare situation, it would lead to an unreasonable result. Every claim arising out of daycare would be covered. It would fall within the exception. That is unreasonable. We do not have two competing reasonable interpretations. Additionally, Your Honor,
counsel, if I may, just to follow up, every claim, what if we had here a child, not the son, but another child for whom compensation was being paid? I mean, your opposing counsel doesn't seem to be advancing that in the same avenues he's advancing this case, that's a distinction that does make a difference.
Well, so, Your Honor, I disagree with the plaintiff's, or I'm sorry, the appellant's perception here. We're not supposed to be focusing on the actor. It's basically almost irrelevant that it's Jason or whoever who puts the pillows on Justin. The claim is against Mrs. Real, and we're supposed to be looking at her liability, that's the theory, and her activities. And is this activity that she's engaging in something that's usual to her business or not usual to her business?
It all depends on how you define it. Is the activity supervising her child, for whom she does not get paid, or is her activity supervising children, for which she does get paid? So it's just a matter of generality and being specific. How specific you define it leads to the result.
Your Honor, if I may, I just want to quickly respond to Justice Babich. I'll get back.
Yes.
I want to just to say, Justice Babich, that just because language is difficult does not mean it's ambiguous. There is a plethora of Wisconsin authority that says just because other jurisdictions have decided differently does not mean it's ambiguous. Now, getting back, Justice Bradley, to your argument that, or your question, I'm sorry, that it depends on the perspective of how you define it, that's exactly right. And that is the problem with there's basically two tests that are different than the Wisconsin test. There is the Virginia-Alabama test, which looks at just the activity in isolation, looks at it in a vacuum and says, is this the kind of activity that normally is done outside of business? Because if it is, it falls within the exception. And it's over-inclusive. Everything in daycare would be covered. The exception swallows the rule. The problem with the other test, and that's a test that's adopted by Alabama and Missouri, is that they kind of take this wide-angle approach. They don't look at the actual activity giving rise to the claim. They come back and they say, oh, well, generally what daycare people do is that they provide a safe environment for profit. And because they do it for profit, it can't be usual to non-business because by definition it's for business. And nothing falls within the exception. So we've got the two main alternative tests are have problems. One is over-inclusive, one is under-inclusive, and that's the beauty of the Rufner test. The Roofner test is case-specific, and you actually look at the activity. And you say, what activity are they claiming gave rise to the problem here, and is it normally or not normally part of this person's business?
But you run afoul of the same problem. How do you define the activity, specifically or generally? Do you define this activity as an activity of taking care of your child, or do you define this activity as an activity of supervising a child?
Justice Bradley, I don't agree. I mean, here we are specifically saying it is Stephanie Reels taking care of her child. We are defining it very specifically. And so we say very specifically, does she do that normally while she's in doing her business? And the answer is yes. If you wanted to take it more generally, clearly it's not going to fall within the exception. But we'll grant them the specificity of how they've pled it, and even how they're pleading it, it won't fall within the exception. And that is, I say again and again, the beauty of Roofner. It allows different specificity. I mean, it allows for, I think, appropriate specificity, and it's something that can be applied in a variety of different cases. And, of course, that's your challenge, trying to adopt a test that is going to provide guidance to the practicing bar and insurance companies that will span more than one case. And the test adopted by Roofner will do that.
Counsel, as I read the policy, it appears to me that the policy sets up a two-step process. Analytical framework. The first prong of that framework is to determine whether or not the injury arose out of a business pursuit. And that's such very broad language that nobody could test that here.
Right.
This arose out of a business pursuit. Then the second test set out by the policy is that this doesn't apply if it arose out of a business pursuit out of activities which are usual to non-business persons. So then the answer to that, to me, seems somewhat clear that the non-business pursuit was taking care of her own child. Then you seem to set up a third test, which is, okay, if you go through step one and step two, you can still prevail because there's another exception to the exception, which is unless it's normally associated with the business.
No, Your Honor, that is exactly...
That seems the fundamental difference.
And I understand that, and that is precisely what we need to be usual to a non-business pursuit. Now, they're not saying usual to a non-business pursuit in a vacuum. They're saying what is usual to a non-business pursuit in this case. If it's usual to the policyholder's business pursuit, it is not usual to the non-business pursuit, because that's how they're defining it. Okay, they're trying to determine what does it mean to be usual, and they say if the activity is usual to the business pursuit, then the exception doesn't apply. Because if it's commonly associated with the business, that's supposed to be excluded. That's how the court defines it. And so what you look at is you say, okay, is this something that's normally there? Because if it is, remember, this is a personal homeowner's policy. They're trying to provide coverage in the personal sphere of the person. They want to exclude coverages that are associated with the person's business. If it happens that there's something that comes up that's, you know, yeah, it fits the but-for causal relation that it falls within the business, but it's not a risk that's normally there, the company's saying, we'll grant you that coverage. But certainly it is an exception. You know, I mean, it's by definition finite. So the conclusion that Stephanie Reel, her supervision of her son is something that she does as part and parcel of her daycare, that should be excluded. You know, I mean, we have a baby who died in daycare because her son, you know, did something. That's the kind of thing that this was intending to exclude because it's part of her business. And it's consistent with what the entire theory of homeowners coverage is. If she had intended to cover her business risks, she should have either bought a daycare policy or she should have obtained a rider if she could have qualified to her homeowner's coverage.
But on that theory, she purchased the policy, the family purchased the policy to insure against the risk that they would be held liable for the negligent acts of their children.
And she's not being held liable for the negligent act of her child.
No, that's the accidental, theory. Because it's 5 and 7.
But that's the theory of the plaintiff's case here.
No, it's not, and there has been some confusion. This is not a claim for vicarious liability. She is not being held liable for the negligence of the kid. She is being held liable for her own negligence in failing to supervise.
Perhaps I'm not being clear. What I'm talking about is the second of the causes of action here. There's one
right.
cause of action against her
right.
in her role as a daycare provider for
right.
negligent supervision of the child that died. There's
right.
a second cause of action that is the theory of liability is that she was a negligent mother, basically, is what the
right.
claim is. She was a negligent mother. She didn't properly care for or supervise or control her own child, and that caused the death of
right.
the other child who was in her care.
Right.
And so she did take out this policy to insure against the latter sort of a risk, did she not?
No.
For being a negligent mother, which is the allegation here, right?
Certainly.
Not for being a negligent daycare provider, but for being a negligent mother.
When she is a negligent mother, not in the course and scope of her business.
So if a neighbor child had come over to play and the same scenario occurred, she'd be covered.
Let me ask you a few questions. Is she providing daycare at the time?
No. It's just a neighbor child coming over to play.
Right.
Or...
Yes.
No, and her child caused harm.
Right. She would be covered.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important? Why did you ask Justice Sykes that question? Why is it important if she was providing daycare at that time? If this child was a first-time visitor to her home while she was providing daycare to three other kids, and a fourth child just comes into the home for the first time and the same thing happens?
And that was getting back to Justice Wilcox's question earlier about the neighbor who comes over, because what Rufner says is, okay, we've got to determine whether or not this is a risk which is normally associated with their daycare. If she's providing the daycare and the child comes over and it's a first time, that would fall within the exception because it's not the risk that's normally associated. But again, if this kid comes over every day at 1 o'clock and plays from 1 to 3, it's a risk that's normally associated.
Where does the policy say that?
The policy says that in the exception is for activities which are usual to non-business pursuits.
Yeah, but you see, that's a general terminology, and I think that's one of the issues here. So daycare, the usual activities associated with daycare generally are not that your child is going, that for whom, who is not in the daycare, your child is going to injure somebody. The usual risks associated with daycare are that one of the children is going to injure another, or that you're going to injure another child, etc. So putting all this into context and asking whether the neighbor child comes over often or not seems to me to be changing the language of the policy. I don't think that's what usual means in that policy. How many times the neighbor child came over. I think it's whether it's usual in the general business of daycare.
Well, at least in Rufner, Your Honor, they looked at usual in terms of a temporal because they analyzed whether or not the installation of the hoist was something that was frequently associated with the business. And they held that because it was done on a one-time basis, it was not frequently associated, so it was not usual.
Maybe my non-context argument would apply there, too, that that's not usually part of that business, that hoist. Otherwise, you have to look at every particular aspect of the business. Maybe in Justice Wilcox's home garage business, they generally don't put a car up on a jack for a variety of reasons. They only do things where you don't have to raise the car. This one time, they put it up on a jack. Or maybe they always put it up on a jack. That would be usual in that business.
Right. And that is what Roofner and we believe the best test would instruct the court to do, and that is to look and say what goes on in that policyholder's business, because if it's part of that policyholder's business, then it's excluded. If it is incidental to, not, you know, it's usual to the non-business, it's not normal to the business, then it would be excluded. It would fall within the exception. So, Your Honors, we believe that the Roofner test is the best of the tests that have been articulated by the courts around the country. It is able to be applied in a myriad of situations. It can be articulated. It can be applied. We think that it's the test that should be applied. When that test is applied to the facts before you, the trial court's decision that there is no coverage, that this case does not fall within the exception, is correct, and we respectfully request that it be affirmed.
Is there any place in that test for an inquiry into the nature of the duty that's been breached or allegedly breached?
Well, I think so, Your Honor, because in terms of looking at what the activity is that's giving rise to the harm, whether or not that activity would give rise to tort liability, one would be looking at whether or not there's a duty. For instance, if the daycare person had no legal duty to be watching the child who gives harm, then that's not a viable theory, so it doesn't impact coverage. Okay, so I think that that's where the issue of whether or not there's a legal duty would come in.
Well, this gets back to the question I was asking earlier, is that the nature of the duty that's allegedly been breached here is twofold. The plaintiffs have alleged a breach of her duty in connection with her daycare business to supervise the child who died. And another duty that is allegedly breached or has allegedly been breached here is that which arises out of the defendant's activity as a parent, which is independent of her role as a daycare provider and therefore falls within the exception to the exclusion. And so if that's part of the Roofner analysis, doesn't that carry the day here? Because the two duties are independent of one another, legally speaking, regardless of whether we have to engage in some sort of a more hyper-technical analysis of the facts and figure out, you know, how often some sort of a thing occurs as a factual matter in order to determine whether the business pursuits exception applies or doesn't apply.
I think, Justice Sykes, the problem is that you are taking a very general and non-case specific approach to what is the duty and what's being alleged, and that what has to be done is it has to be analyzed in the context of the case before you. Yes, generally, watching children is something we as parents do outside of business. In this case, Stephanie Real did that as part and parcel of her daycare, and consequently, it's excluded from coverage.
Can you give us some examples of usual activities that would fall within the exception?
Usual activities that would fall within the exception?
Usual activities.
Well, I can give you examples of usual activities that are not usual to their business. For instance, one of the things that occurs to me is, let's say that I come to the daycare to pick up my daughter and she's asleep. I decide that I'm going to wait instead of leave, and the daycare mom sits down and we're going to have coffee. And she tries to open the window while she's pouring my coffee and burns me as she spills it all over me. You know, that is an activity that is kind of usual to non-business pursuits. I mean, making coffee and pouring it. And it doesn't happen to be something that is commonly done in her daycare. She doesn't do it on an everyday part. And so
she
it would
fall. Coffee there all the time, and the dads who pick up the kids do it, and the dads scolded, then you would argue otherwise that it's usual part of the business.
If she was such a good daycare that she provided coffee to her parents as they're going to work, then I might say, yeah, that's usual. It's part of her business. But no, I mean, and again, I think that it has to be that specific. I mean, if it's something that they normally do, then it's supposed to be out.
Isn't that just a recipe for gobs of coverage litigation? I mean, why don't we just say, let's focus on what the duty is that's allegedly been breached, because we take out insurance policies to insure against our liability, against liability that arises because of a duty of care. And
actually,
so why don't we just focus on that? Whatever the theory of liability is in the case determines coverage.
Actually, Your Honor, if you were to focus on the theory of liability, I think that's the greater danger. Because then, in every case, somebody's going to try to parse what was done to come up with a theory of liability that they're going to bring outside.
Well, you get that it has to be a recognized theory of liability under state tort law, and if it's not, they're not going to get very far.
Yes, it does, but I think that the cases around the country will demonstrate that that kind of creative pleading is what we're going to get. It's not a perfect situation.
Counsel, your red light's on, but
yes.
Do you want to say anything about Reformation Week?
I would just quickly like to address Reformation. Thank you, Your Honors. The law on Reformation is that there has to be evidence of mutual mistake. There was absolutely no evidence introduced at the trial court that Leonard Real, asked for daycare coverage, and certainly Kurt Fritz did not intend to provide it. As a matter of law, there is no claim of Reformation. And additionally, for the fact that my company, Continental, under no uncertain circumstances, would not have issued this policy had they known that Stephanie Real was providing daycare on her premises with a child under the age of one. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, mm-hmm. Ms. Unger. Mr. Evenson, you have several minutes in rebuttal.
I was struck by the question that Justice Babich raised, and it reminded me of one of the cases which discussed the meaning of the exception, and it used the word enigma and said that there was no point going further in trying to analyze this exception with that characterization. I hear in her argument the old test that was articulated by the Court of Appeals in Bartell, that is the tainted analysis, almost the but-for. And if we're going to go back to the tainted analysis, I think we run into the same type of difficulty and the same litigation is going to be generated as to what is tainted and what is not tainted. We agree that the Roofner case provides the appropriate test. The two factors listed in Roofner are temporal and also frequency. But they are only listed as examples by the Court of Appeals in Roofner. Certainly there are other factors which we believe exist here as far as the separation of the actors themselves and the activities that can satisfy the Roofner test as far as differentiating between the context and the activity.
So state the test. What do you if you were going to write the opinion of this court, what would you write? You'd write first reverse, but tell me why. Okay? What would you write?
Your Honor, I would adopt the Roofner test, but I would make it clear that in applying this language, but if I was writing this opinion, I would hold this language to be ambiguous because I don't see how these courts at the highest level in the various states can reach the variety of opinion.
You know what, why don't you restate the Roofner test as you understand it?
The Roofner test, as I understand it, is that one looks at first, does the claim arise within the business context? And then does the activity that actually causes the harm, you look at those two factors and you see how interrelated they are. And you analyze that certainly with the factors that they have utilized, temporal, frequency, but with other things as well, such as the difference in actors, which we have here, or any other factors that can be presented to clarify for the trial court, which is going to have to wrestle with that claim.
So you don't look at daycare in the abstract. You look at daycare in this home.
I think you have to, and that's really what the cases tell us, is that each one of these is very fact-specific.
Okay, because it's ambiguous, you may have strict construction, but this isn't a question of strict construction against the insurance company. This is a question of how you apply this test, whether you apply it. You don't usually say, I'm going to apply the test strictly against the insurance company. Do you know what I'm saying?
I agree. I think Roofner, though, allows for fairness in the application of the test, fairness to both sides.
So what you have is, Justice Sykes indicated, is, you know, almost every single one of these cases is a fact-finding case, and the decision of the fact-finder, whether it be a judge or jury, determines it.
I think with this language, that's what you're going to wind up with. It by its very nature, is going to generate litigation.
So the language you're suggesting would be that no business activity, period. I mean, that would be without the without the exception that we're talking about. Because here, it seems to me that as we go around that, the exception could swallow the entire exclusion, the business exclusion, unless we have that language that you're suggesting.
I don't believe that a finding in our favor in this case is going to result in this exception swallowing the exclusion. I think the fact that we have, on the one hand and with regard to one claim, acknowledged we're out, and yet with regard to this claim that we have a viable theory. For instance, had Justin Vandenberg been placed upstairs in this bedroom and tipped over in this child seat and suffocated, not as a result of Jason Real, there wouldn't have been a claim, because the only negligence then would have been Mrs. Real. The separate actor is the distinction. My time is through. Thank you.
Justice Prosser has a question for you.
Could you summarize briefly how was Mrs. Real a negligent parent in relation to Jason?
Well, certainly that was not something that we've had an opportunity to develop full factually through depositions. Everyone involved in the case appreciated that issues of law and coverage were going to be the primary thing, and in fact, Judge Dyer bifurcated so that we would deal with the issues of coverage initially. But I believe that it would be possible for a jury to conclude that she perhaps didn't instruct Jason on the delicacy of an infant, didn't instruct him on the danger of suffocation. I still remember my mother telling me not to play with dry cleaning bags. We don't know some of those facts, and that those would take development at that level. But further, she knew once the television was on that he was in that room. Did she question him as to what, if anything, he had done with regard to Justin? Clearly, we still have to prove our case in the trial court, but those are factual issues that we haven't had a chance to develop fully yet.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, attorneys Evenson, Olson, and Unger, for a case well argued before us. And with that said, I now close the hearing on this, our second case. The court is in recess and will be meeting with various people during the lunch hour. I think we're expected to back at about 2. If we're a few moments late, we apologize in advance. With that, we're in recess. Thank you again.